Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to the New Evangelicals Response. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Wednesday as we respond to commentary on the pressing issues of our day, offering a thoughtful response rooted in love, justice, inclusivity, and of course, non-dehumanization. Let's get into it. Hey, what's up, friends? Okay, different kind of TNE response content coming your way. As you know, we're in a two-part series talking about the massive news drop that is Richard Hayes writing a book, changing his mind, going from a non-affirming stance to an affirming stance. Now, this, I will acknowledge that this is a little bit of some Bible academic nerd level stuff, okay? But it's really important because, as you're going to hear, Richard Hayes is one of the most influential New Testament and just biblical scholars of our time. And what he says has a massive effect on how other Christians perceive the Bible and what it teaches. So we already had part one with Dan Koch, and I wanted to bring on a different perspective. So I brought on my friend, Dr. Angela Parker. She's a womanist theologian. She's actually been in classes under Richard Hayes. And as you're going to hear, she has kind of a dualist or a both and perspective of the good that this could be, but also some of the frustration that she has as someone like Richard coming out with this book and being widely celebrated, despite having a non-affirming view for 30 years and writing authoritatively on the subject that has hurt a lot of queer people. So I'll let her explain the position. I love Dr. Parker. She's been on the podcast several times. You're going to hear me say all that in the intro when we first start talking, but I'm just a huge fan. I really, really, really recommend her book, If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? She will change your perspectives on so many things. So, Dr. Parker, if you're watching or listening, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Friends, I hope that you enjoy this episode. As always, if you want to support our work, we are a nonprofit organization. We do all of this work completely paywall-free. Donating is the most direct way to help make all of this possible as we hold space for thousands of people as they navigate a better path forward in your faith. If you are watching this on YouTube, a subscribe and a like on this video would be great. And also, of course, your thoughts via the comments. If you're listening on podcasts, giving this episode a rating and a review and making sure that you're subscribed to our podcast also helps us out so, so much. All right, friends, here's my conversation with Dr. Angela Parker. Talk to you all later on. Okay, wow, I'm so excited, Dr. Angela Parker. It is truly an honor to have you on the show again. You've been on the podcast before. You've done a Theology 101 group for us before. I've met you in person twice now, and here you are back on the show. So thank you for making time. It means so much.
I am so happy to be with you. And let me say, the enthusiasm is returned back to you because I love having conversations with you, Tim.
I am honored. I was thinking about the first time I met you. You were also featured in the 1946 documentary by our friend Rocky, who that documentary was amazing. And I was invited to the premiere in New York City. So me and my wife, Sarah, went. And I'm sitting in the theater and I see you pop up on the screen. And I go to Sarah, oh my gosh, that's Dr. Angela Parker. I'm such a huge fan. And then it turns out you were there in person as well. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. So it was so cool meeting you the first time, and then of course meeting you back in Georgia, et cetera. So yeah,
yes,
I really love your work. You've written an amazing book, If God Still Believes, Why Can't I? And I again, just really changed my perspective on so many things. You're a womanist theologian, you're an academic, you're a professor, all the good stuff. You got the street cred, Dr. Parker. You got the street cred, you know.
So, yeah.
So I kind of want to hop right into this conversation because something has happened in the, I guess we can say like white-centered academic Christian scholarship world, I think is maybe the best way I can put it. There's a man named Richard Hayes. Now, I don't know much about him. I didn't read many of his books, et cetera, but he, from my understanding, has written many of the core textbooks that are used in Christian universities today. And he is releasing a new book. Now, he's 75 years old. He's retired. But he's releasing a new book in September that I believe he co-wrote with his son called The Widening of God's Mercy, Sexuality Within the Biblical Story. And it comes out in September. And the whole point of it is Richard changing his mind from a non-affirming standpoint to an affirming standpoint.
Yeah.
It seems like it broke the internet in the circles that I see in my algorithms. And I saw quite a plethora of different ways to interpret this. I saw friends of mine in the queer community who were like, this is cool, but also is there repentance that's going to happen? Then I saw some other friends of mine who are more like white progressives who were like, oh my gosh, this can blow the whole thing wide open and really, you know, open the doors up for a wide inclusivity in evangelical spaces. And then I saw your response as well. And I was like, oh, very fascinating. I have a lot of questions about this. So I wanted to bring you on. We're going to do a two-part series. And I wanted to bring you on to get your thoughts on what's happening and help the audience kind of unpack all of the layers. So my first question to you is, do you know Richard Hayes? What's your experience? Have you read his content? And what's your connection to him?
Sure. So I got my Master's of Theological Studies from Duke Divinity School in 2010. So I was a student of Dr. Hayes in my last semester. I learned 1 Corinthians, well, Greek exegesis of 1 Corinthians with Dr. Hayes. Mm. And I tell the story in my book about how I was the only African-American and the only woman in the classroom. Right. And the experience of being at Duke and that being my experience as the only woman and African-American in the classroom was an experience that my colleagues in the classroom would ask me, are you in the right classroom? And I also had more work as a result of being a student in the classroom. It was almost as if my professors did not believe that I actually knew the Greek language and could actually do the work. And I remember also there were classes that were considered upper level New Testament classes in which I petitioned to be a part of, but my petitions for two particular classes, one with Dr. Hayes, were denied. So I was not even allowed to take certain classes that were open to master's students because they didn't feel like I had enough experience to actually be in the classroom. And so I often talk about my time at Duke Divinity as time served, almost like a prison sentence, in order to get into a PhD program. And I remember it was probably the last few weeks of the semester, and I was waiting for acceptances into a PhD program. And Dr. Hayes had just let out our 1 Corinthians class. And I was sitting there checking my laptop, and all the other students had left. And he said, Angela, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking to see if I've received any responses to PhD programs that I applied to. And he said, he kind of gave me a quizzical look and he said, well, did you apply to Duke? And I said, before I even had a chance to censor myself, I said, I looked at him, I said, like, who would I work with here? None of you like me.
Wow.
I was just like,
just said it.
Yeah, there was no way I would even waste the $65 application fee to like try to get into a PhD program at Duke University. And so my experience was I felt tolerated in the classroom. And it was only after I got a PhD and actually got a job that my Duke professors began to realize that I was actually a force to be reckoned with in the field of biblical scholarship. So that was my introduction to Richard Hayes and what it felt like being a student of his for me. Now, of course, this is just my particular experience, and there are others who I know in the field who have worked with Hayes and are highly complimentary, which I can understand completely. Sure. But that just was not my experience.
When you said that to him, what was his response when you were like, none of you like me? Was he just kind of like, yeah, what did he say?
Yeah, he was just like, oh,
I had no idea, Dr. Parker. You know, like, oh, really? Okay. That's helpful to know. Now, can you maybe speak about just the impact of Richard Hayes, like from an academic perspective? I mean, how influential are his writings, et cetera?
Yeah, so I would say that Richard Hayes is probably one of the most influential New Testament scholars of our age, because his work on Pistis Christi, or the faith of Jesus, or faithfulness of Jesus, was one of those watershed moments that opened up the conversation in Pauline literature about faithfulness of Christ. So he's influential in that field. And he is influential with regards to his book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And in The Moral Vision of the New Testament, he has a chapter entitled Homosexuality. And in that chapter, that's where a lot of evangelicals go to in order to put forth this idea of love the sinner, hate the sin. Mm. So very James Dobson type. And they also get the idea of, and I would never say this now, but the way he says it is, homosexual Christians need to change their orientation. Mm. So you get a lot of the language of changing one's orientation, changing one's identity to this almost monolithic identity in Christ. And also a little bit of the conversation of, so what do we do with homosexual Christians?
Yeah.
And that's been problematic for so many of our LGBTQIA plus siblings over the years, that churches have said, well, you can be converted, or you can change your orientation, or you can live a celibate life and not have any kind of relationship. And they make it sound like that's okay, that that's a part of God's flourishing. And for those of us who are not part of the LGBTQIA plus community, but read this work, we also see the a similar idea of having to change your identity. And that's what I was feeling as a student, that I had to become a white male biblical scholar in order to be accepted. And so I imagine that my LGBTQIA plus friends would read Hayes's work and feel like they had to become a cishet or a heterosexual Christian in order to be accepted.
Mm.
And that's problematic.
Mm. Is it very safe to say that, at least in the American context, the world of biblical scholarship is dominated by mostly white men?
Oh, it's very safe to say that.
I figured, but again, I didn't know for a fact, but it's in my experience. I mean, even in the space I occupy, a lot of the folks I just naturally end up talking to are white men. You know, they just are the ones that I hear from often. And so that is helpful. And again, like, thanks to the work of you and many others, I'm slowly getting a set of different eyes to see that for the first time in my own life, where it's like, there's a lot of white dudes around here, you know, painting these pictures. Now, of course, many of them do great work, but they come from a cultural context. And there are other people with different perspectives and different eyes of how they understand and see the world that have very important things to say about how we understand the Bible, right? To your point.
Yeah, but it also comes back to who gets into PhD programs, who, like, Hayes has trained many PhDs. So he has now a legacy of scholars across the country who had been trained by him and who are doing similar things in New Testament studies.
Right.
So the train keeps rolling. The similar ideas keep being perpetrated over and over again. And for me, I look at schools across the country and ask, oh, where are the Black women who are coming up? Where can they go and get a PhD and actually get a PhD that takes truly into consideration their identity as Black women? And it was only by the grace of God that I was able to get to Chicago Theological Seminary where that could happen for me. And so, and to also to be trained under an LGBTQIA plus scholar in Ken Stone. So Ken Stone, a queer Hebrew Bible scholar, was on my dissertation committee and was a balancing part of my own work and helping me see blind spots in my own work. But if you don't have those scholars around you, you won't see your blind spots.
Hi, my name is Katie, and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am a proud supporter of TNE. Like many of you, I have spent my entire life in evangelical Christianity, but my life took a turn when my best friend came out to me as a lesbian. Long story short, I went to therapy, I came out as queer, and realized I was in love with my best friend, and we are now engaged and soon to be married. However, this journey has been full of painful moments, and coming out to my religious family has been the most dehumanizing experience. In addition, my fiancé and I both worked at a non-affirming Christian university, so when we came out, we were fired. Through all of these difficult moments, TNE has been there with compassionate ideas and language that I could use in hard conversations. This work has been a lifeline for me in my faith journey, and it must continue. And that is why I am so proud to support the work of the New Evangelicals.
Okay, so it's clear from what I read and also what you said that Richard Hayes has influenced a lot of people with the theology. I mean, a lot of what you even said about, you know, well, you know, queer people can change their orientation or hate the sin, love the sinner. That type of stuff we hear downstream all the time, right? I mean, I hear it all the time. Even though I never heard of Richard Hayes until recently, it's clear that his teaching on, especially this topic, has influenced potentially millions of people, right? Through one way or another.
Yes.
So when you first heard about this book, now it's not out yet. I'm not sure if you've read it yet. It comes out in September. When you first heard about this book and the title and that pretty much Richard has changed his mind, what went through your head? I'm just so curious, like your initial thoughts.
My initial thoughts were anger.
Mm.
And I'm probably still sitting on the angry fence.
Mm.
Because my brain went to how many people have been harmed by 30 years of teaching?
Yeah.
And my own feelings of harm are really nothing compared to the harm that I know LGBTQIA plus folks have experienced as a result of his teaching and how his position has been taken up in so many churches. And I have to wonder, because Duke Divinity School is a UMC school, a United Methodist school, a lot of United Methodists go to Duke to do their MDivs.
Hmm.
If that has anything to do with the UMC division that is going on globally.
Yeah.
And how that has played into, you know, what we're seeing with the UMC denomination dividing. So I think there are so many ramifications that have come from his work.
Yeah.
And like I said, I have not read the book yet since it's not out. It comes out in September.
Sure.
But the framing from Yale Press of a great man changing his mind and the outpouring of love and support for that great man changing his mind makes me angry and is highly problematic. Because if 30 years from now, if there's something that I change my mind on, Are they going, like, and I'm saying they, other academics or the people of the world who I may have harmed for 30 years.
Sure.
In my positionality as a Black woman, would I receive any of that grace? Probably not. Hmm.
Yeah. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I gotta, I'm going to be completely transparent with you because, you know, you and I see us as friendly. I am really torn between two worlds, I feel like, where part of me is like, man, this book could be a huge game changer where we look back in history and go, you know, this changing of the mind let other people who maybe were on the fence, so to speak, or who were afraid to say it, say, look, I can cite an authoritative source. And so that could be cool. But I also really do feel exactly what you're saying, where it's like, well, we're looking at 30 years of theology. And, you know, I track this stuff for a living at this point. Like, I see the rise of Christian nationalism. I see how queer folks, how they're dehumanized day in and day out with words like groomer and stuff, right? And how a lot of this stuff flows from the white evangelical world and their academics. And so I feel myself really torn here because I see the potential of like, this could be a game changer, but I also see what you're saying of like, yeah, but like, we're going to just give this dude a pass. Now, maybe in the book, the opening statement is, this is my act of repentance, right? I am so sorry for all the harm I've caused and I want to do better, which is why I wrote the book. That could be a thing, but we just don't know that at this point. But for you, like, is there a way for someone like Richard to repent, so to speak, while not, of course, dismissing or minimizing the harm that he caused, and giving someone like a Richard that path forward of, you know what, he's really trying to make amends at year 75 in his life. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think I'm still Jesus follower, still holding on to shreds of something regarding Jesus.
Yeah. For sure.
There has to be for me some element of, yes, there can be some forgiveness that comes about. I hope that part of his work is to point people in the direction of queer scholars who have already done the biblical scholarship over the text that he is now changing his mind about. That he does not become the queer biblical scholar that others have already been for so many years.
Yes. Yes. This is a key point that I don't want the audience to miss. Right. And I've said this in my own way in the space I occupy, where I realized that white men have a propensity of invading spaces and kind of positioning themselves as the new guru, right? And overwriting the work that people before them have been doing all along. I've seen it in the deconstruction space. Exactly. I've seen it in the progressive space. That there's a reason why I don't really use the term anywhere on our platform that I'm a progressive Christian, because I've noticed that even in white progressive spaces, I'm like, I don't know, you know, like, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't know if I'm really on board for that thing that you're doing. And you're right in the sense of, I have noticed patterns where it seems like white men, like Richard probably could not cite one queer scholar in this book. And a lot of white progressives aren't going to be like, well, Richard, like, people have been doing the work before you. They'd be like, oh, this is a huge breakthrough, right? And to your point, there have been people for decades, biblical scholars who are either queer or who focus on queer issues, who have been doing the work, who have been totally marginalized and overlooked by that whole world because they're not biblical, right? And now the concern can be that Richard comes along and says, I changed my mind. And they go, wow, Richard, this is groundbreaking work. And you're like, this has been out there for a long time.
It's already been done. What right. new are you adding that has already been done? I don't think there can be anything new that could be added.
Hmm.
Go back and read the scholars who have already done this work.
Yeah.
And then have your congregations read those scholars. And then actually ordain folks in your churches.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then go out and fight the fight against white Christian nationalism.
No, for sure. Like, no, please. Amen to that. You know, like, I would love to see Richard Hayes in his book be like, and white Christian nationalism is one of our biggest threats to marginalized folks and democracy. You know, I would love to see that because you're right. Like, these things really are intertwined. I mean, I am convinced more and more, and it pains me to say this because this is the tradition that radicalized me to be this Jesus follower, you know, but the more I read from folks like yourself or Jamar Tisby, Anthea Butler Brown, Russell J. Hawkins, The Bible Told Them So, and others, I'm like, you know, white evangelicals have been on the wrong side consistently in my American tradition. And I don't see a ton of willingness to acknowledge the decades of harm that we've caused, not just to queer folks, of course, but to the Black community. I mean, the list goes on and on. It was Bob Jones and white evangelicalism that was insistent that the Bible was clear on maintaining segregation, right? And it is difficult for me to wrestle with that part of my history where, yes, have there been evangelicals in the early Wesleyan tradition that were abolitionists and, you know, in that were doing what they could to fight the federal government and to be part of the Underground Railroad? Of course. But for every one of those, there was like 100 white evangelicals who were on the wrong side of that issue. And that's what's so difficult, I think, for a lot of people when they deconstruct to reckon with, is just how problematic so much of our history and our theology really is, frankly.
Exactly. Well, and that's the work that the white evangelical needs to do.
Yeah.
And so you need more folks like you calling people to do that because they don't listen to me.
No, I listen to you, but no, you're, I mean, this is a really, I didn't mean to really kind of go here, but I think we can't avoid it that you're right. You know, like when you're, I have two other good friends of mine, Janice and Ashley, they're actual personal friends, but they come on the podcast every now and then. And we were talking about this exact thing that even folks who find themselves deconstructing or progressive spaces, you're still conditioned to see white men as like the biggest authority on whatever topic they're talking about, right? Like your brain's just conditioned to see, oh, this white dude is authoritative and maybe this other person is not as authoritative. In fact, I found myself doing things that I'm like, this isn't healthy. I mean, one example is my friend Daniel Bonanora, who's a Palestinian Christian and scholar. I've only ever reached out to him to talk about the genocide in Palestine, nothing else. I'm like, wait, why do I do that? Why am I only using him when it's about a Palestinian issue? Yeah. And why do I pigeonhole him to be only an expert here when for other white progressive or even academics, I've had him talk about all kinds of issues. Like, why am I doing that, right? So some of this stuff goes very deep that you don't even see until you really start thinking very critically about why you're doing these things.
Right, exactly. Why am I doing these things? So we constantly have to be thinking critically about who we're having conversations with, who we're talking to, who we're inviting into our spaces. And it can't just be the, okay, here's the one Black person that I know. Here's the one Palestinian person that I know. Here's the one gay person that I know. See, I've got one.
Yeah.
And that's not the answer to the problem.
100%. This is like my personal confession time, I guess, on the air, but I have caught myself many times being like, why do I treat Black people or queer folks as monolithic? Meaning if I have one Black friend, so to speak, right? Oh, they speak for all Black people. But for me, when it comes to my white friends, I totally see the nuance and how everyone sees things super differently. Why am I, again, as a progressive, so-called progressive, you can repeat some of the same cycles that are very much baked into white supremacy if you're not really careful. And just assume that because Dr. Parker has this view, all Black academics have this view. That's super terrible. It's way more complicated than that. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they won't, because I can already name some Black scholars that I know who will not have this view that I have. I'm sitting here thinking of like two or three, and I'm like, oh, yeah, they're going to be mad that I've said this. Oh, well, they'll be fine. But they are kind of like Richard Hayes dude bros, even though they're Black male academics. And I'll say it's probably mostly Black male academics who I can think of who would be upset with me having this conversation. But again, you did not walk in my shoes, so.
Totally.
You'll be fine.
So do you think there is a side to this? Let's just speak maybe purely pragmatically for a second, right? Because I tend to be a very pragmatic thinker. You know, yes, I think everything you said is right and on the money and yes, right? And is it maybe both and where it's like, this guy is problematic and yes, this book actually could be one of the big dominoes that changes things broadly speaking, and that is also a win? How do you see this?
Oh, yeah. I can definitely live in the both and. I can live in that cognitive dissonance. And But as an aside, most Christians can't live in cognitive dissonance. It has to be either or. And people have a difficulty living in the both and that, yes, I can both be angry that this book is coming out and positioning itself the way that it is. And I can also pray and hope for the best that there will be change that occurs in denominations, in churches, that there is some liberation from the hateful rhetoric against our LGBTQIA plus folks, that there can be actual flourishing, that people can imagine the flourishing of LGBTQIA siblings in ordination, in leading churches, in actually being full participating members of various denominations wherever they find themselves. That's what I hope for. And that's the and that I'm often holding on to, that even if this book has, you know, behind it that salvific white male identity, that it will actually help and influence in areas that they wouldn't accept me talking or queer Christians talking, that it will open the door to better conversations. So I can live in that cognitive dissonance.
I'm with you. I'm with you all the way on this, 100%. Like, I'm getting more and more infuriated the more I see of like just how these standards work and like what is accepted as great and awesome and people that are overshadowed by that. And I'm also pragmatically like, whatever it takes to change things, I will do and tolerate, you know, because you're right. Like, I really believe, and I hope I'm right on this, but I believe hopefully within a decade or a little bit more than that, we look back and go, what were these evangelicals thinking with how they treated, you know, not just their queer Christian siblings in Christ, but just the queer community in general in America, right?
Yeah.
I hope that we look back. I hope that we look back at people like Charlie Kirk, like how we look back at David Duke from the KKK and go, what? These people were on our airwaves? They had huge followings? Oh my gosh, right? That is my hope. And if this book does that, great. But I don't want to minimize, right, the other layers to this very complicated topic where other folks can still be overlooked, like those queer scholars that you're talking about who have been doing this work for so long that maybe have even paved the way for Richard to even have these views, right? And so we have to be aware of that as we navigate this.
Yes, we have to be aware of that. And for your listeners, read Ken Stone, read Teresa Hornsby, read James Hoke, read Chris Grenoff. I feel like in this moment, we need to name those scholars who are doing and have been doing all this work. And we have to say, read Eric Thomas. So let me say the names again. Ken Stone, Teresa Hornsby, Christopher Grenoff, Eric Thomas, James Hoke, good Carrie Aldrich, good queer scholars that I know who are doing this work, who need to be on our bookshelves as well, in addition to the hazes of the world.
I totally agree. If there's one thing I've learned from afar, keyword here, afar, is that the work of biblical scholarship is tedious, it's time-consuming, it often goes unthanked, but it actually shapes downstream, it shapes Christian culture in whatever context that they're talking to, right? And so when we're not listening to the voices of biblical scholars who are doing this work and have been doing this work, I also recommend, I don't believe that she's queer, but the work of Dr. Jennifer Byrd, you know, her book, Biblical Sexuality, What Did the Text Say? Great read. I read it and I was like, oh, this is so helpful.
Yes.
Again, though, those books don't go viral, right? They don't do millions of sales. But if we can help push people in that direction or bring them on our platforms, I think that's how we start also changing the tide, right? This both and of sure, if Richard's book reaches people that I can never reach, that's great. But if we can get other folks who've been doing the work for decades to come on and explain their positions and how they got there, that's just as, if not more compelling, right? Because they're the OGs. They've been doing it since the beginning when it wasn't cool and trendy, right?
Right.
Yes, I love that. Well, if you don't mind, after we end this conversation, would you mind just emailing me those names? I'll have Noah put them in the show notes. And maybe we'll try and link to their work.
Yes.
And also, selfishly, I want to reach out to at least a few of them and get them on the podcast. I'm always looking for a wider set of people to talk to. Is there anything else you want to add to this conversation? Anything that you haven't gotten out that you want to just say, you know, while you're here with me talking about this?
I think I just want to say that Richard Hayes is so influential. And even so, right now, the work that I'm doing on faith, that I'm writing on currently, is influenced and in conversation with his work. Because in order to just put down my own thoughts on faith. And even after my experiences at Duke, when I've seen him after getting a PhD, after getting a job, I have to say that he has been gracious. He knows just a little bit of, like, you know, my struggle with Duke and with even the education that I got from there.
Yeah.
But he has been a gracious man. And so I want to highlight his graciousness, even as I hold on to my feelings of being taken aback by his upcoming work and my own feelings of, I think, justified anger as I think about his work. And so as we talk about cognitive dissonance and sitting in the tension, I want to say unequivocally that I'm sitting in that tension and I'm okay with sitting in that tension.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we're going to see what happens in just a few months when this book comes out. And I guess we'll see the impact of all of that. Also, are you writing another book right now? Are you currently writing?
I am writing another book right now.
Oh, okay. Is there a loose release time frame you're looking to release a new book?
No, sometime in 2025. I'll let you know.
Yeah, let me know.
I'll finish it this summer.
Let me know. We'd love to have you back on. Title. Go ahead. Oh, please. I would love that.
All right. Faith Unleashed.
Oh. Faith goodness.
Unleashed. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
So.
I got chills. I got legit chills. Okay. Yeah. Please let me know when I can get a copy of that and I can get you on the podcast again to talk about that. And I'm looking forward to reading it. And your current book right now is If God Still Breathes, Why Can't I? I recommend it to everyone. It's a great, powerful read that I think especially for white folks will really be like, oh, I never thought about these things before. And I think it's just such an important read. So Dr. Parker, I appreciate your work, as you know, and I appreciate you making time kind of last minute to have this conversation with me. We'll definitely keep in touch. We'll see what happens in September. Let me know about your book. Do you have any other public work? I see you on Instagram sometimes. If folks want to follow you, because you do a lot of womanist theologian content, right? Like coming from that womanist perspective, where can folks find your work?
Yes. So they can find me at Boozy Bible Scholar on TikTok and also Boozy Bible Scholar on Instagram. But you can probably see some links to my work through the McAfee School of Theology website. So you can usually find some Christian Century articles that I've done. Mm-hmm. But if you Google me, there will be some articles that will pop up that work that I've done on the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mark as well.
Awesome. Love it. Well, we'll definitely keep in touch and we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.